I'm going to be a little bit briefer about the other two constituencies that I think are there, because I want us to have some time to chat about this. The second constituency that I think you're preaching to, my wager is that you're preaching to, are the unformed, those for whom the Christian life doesn't have a shape to it, a shape of a collection of practices. Eamon Duffy, the great church historian, wrote a book called The Visions of Marabath, and it's about a little parish in England at the eve of the English Reformation. It had the same priest for 46 years, Catholic Church, and he was a detailed journaler. And so for every day of his 46-year parish ministry, he wrote down everything that was happening in his parish and in the town of Marabath, a treasure trove for historians. Well, what was happening in Marabath? Well, the menfolk were making some beeswax candles for use in the liturgy. The women of the parish were sewing a new set of black vestments for their beloved priest. The young people in the parish were raising a flock of sheep and selling the wool for what we would call benevolence offerings. And every member of the congregation was assigned a committee, and that committee was responsible for one of the priests, one of the saint's statues. And on the saint's day, your statue got to be front and center in the liturgy. It was a moment of pride. There's the statue we've been taking care of. On Thursday, they're Catholic. On Friday, by law, they're Anglican. And what happens? Out go the beeswax candles and the statues, and out go the black vestments, and suddenly they're Protestant. And according to Duffy, congregational life collapsed. Not because beeswax candles or black vestments or sheep's wools or statues of saints are essential to the Christian life, but it was because organizing around those pieces of practice was what gave shape to one's Christian commitment and life. And I think it is a sin of Protestantism, especially, I will confess, my particular branch of it in the Reformed tradition, to have a quasi-Gnostic understanding of the Christian faith, that it's a set of beliefs and ideas more than it is what you do with your hands and your feet in terms of the practices of life. Graham Hughes has a book was published posthumously by Graham Hughes, in which he said, there are these two tendencies in the church. There is dispersed sacramentality and condensed sacramentality. Dispersed sacramentality says Jesus has knocked down the wall between the sacred and profane, and now holiness fills the cosmos. The turning of that tree to beautiful red in the fall is just as holy as the transformation in the Eucharist. A U2 song is just as holy as O Sacred Head, How Wounded. Hughes says there's a truth to that theologically, but when everything is holy, nothing is holy. And dispersed sacramentality needs to be held together with condensed sacramentality. This book, this table, this building, this practice is our access to the universal holy. When I taught at Yale this past fall as a visiting professor, I was speaking at a church on the weekend, and I had a very early flight out of LaGuardia Airport on Saturday morning. And so I arranged for Connecticut Airport Limo to pick me up at 4 o'clock in the morning to take me to LaGuardia Airport. My driver picked me up, and I asked him, do you have any other stops between New Haven and LaGuardia? Sometimes they stop at every little town to pick up somebody. He said, no, you're the only one this morning. I said, great. Well, we got about 50 miles down the road, and suddenly he pulls the van off of the interstate to the airport. And I think, what is this? He pulls into an all-night convenience store, and I think, oh, he's going to get some gas or something to eat. But no, he parks his van on the far end of the parking lot. And then I begin to worry as I was going to get mugged or something. But he gets out of the van, goes back into the back, and takes his prayer rug out of the back of the van, spreads it out on the asphalt of the parking lot, faces toward Mecca, and does his prayers. And I think, is there anything in the people that I serve that compares to this capacity to wrap oneself around a practice that embodies one's faith? I think some of the people I'm preaching to have an unformed Christian faith. Don Browning, who taught at the University of Chicago, wrote a little book called The Moral Context of Pastoral Care. And in the book, he said, ministers of a certain generation were trained that when somebody comes to you for pastoral counseling, that what you're supposed to do is to close the door and to say to them, I'm sorry you're having struggles in life, I understand. And I want you to know, in the context of this relationship, there is no right, there is no wrong, there's just grace and total acceptance. And the idea was that in the context of grace and total acceptance, people could potentially put their lives back together and get back out there into the moral fray. That was fine, said Browning, as long as people were coming to us and saying, in effect, I know what I'm supposed to do, I just can't do it. But what happens when people start coming to us as they are today saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to do? At that point, to say there is no right, there is no wrong, is to exacerbate the issue. Nobody wants to wag a finger at people and say, well, I'll tell you what's right. But there is moral inquiry that leads to practices. There is a form to the faith. I was reading online this morning Metropolitan Diary in the New York Times. I don't know whether you read it or not. It's little glimpses of life in the city. And several years ago, a woman wrote in Metropolitan Diary that she went to Bloomingdale's, you know, the fashionable New York department store. She walked over to the women's accessories counter. There was a 20-something clerking there. She reached into her purse and pulled out one leather glove and placed it on the counter and said, I've done it again, I've lost one of my gloves. Do you have this model still in stock or something like it? I'm just like those three little kittens. You know, three little kittens who lost their mittens. Having taken it that far, she decided to take it all the way. Three little kittens who lost their mittens and cried, cried, cried. At which point the 20-something called for security. She said, I didn't expect her to know Shakespeare or the Bible. But when we don't even have nursery rhymes in common, public discourse is no longer possible. I didn't expect her to know Shakespeare or the Bible. And neither do I. There's no practice that's there. Robert Coles used to worry about that when he taught at Harvard. He said, I've got so many students who make A's in ethics and then go back and abuse the housekeeping help in the dorm. They make A's in ethics, but they flunk life. I think we need to give some attention to the shape that Christian living has. And preach about that explicitly to that constituency in our congregation that doesn't know what it's supposed to do. Let me give you a personal example. I have never preached on James 3. Never. In fact, for a long time, I thought it was unworthy to preach on James 3, by the way, goes like this. You better look out for your tongue. It can do a lot of damage. It's like the rudder of a ship. It's a little organ in the body, but you get that thing out of line and the ship can go astray. It's like a little flicker of flame that burns down a forest. The same tongue that praises God then takes people who are created in the image of God and curses them. You better be careful about your tongue. Who would preach on something as strawy as that? It would be a works righteousness sermon about behaving yourself with your mouth. I've got a 47-year-old daughter named Melanie, and I have entered into that phase of life that some of you may have already yourselves, and that is where you have children who are now adults, and you have an adult-to-adult relationship. And it's a marvelous time. You're still parent, they're still your daughter or son, but you've got this adult-to-adult relationship, and I have that with Melanie, and it's good. But in order to get there, you have to go over some treacherous territory. And in one of our conversations not long ago, Melanie was remembering a time when she was a teenager, and we were having one of those teenage daughter, father of teenage daughter. We had a lot of them. We got through all of them. We now have a great adult-to-adult relationship. But in the heat of battle, she remembers that I said, "Melanie, you're nothing but trouble to me." Not the kind of thing I would say. I don't remember saying it, but she does. And 25 years later, she's still trying to take the poison dart out of her heart. Somebody needed to preach to me about the practice of speaking in a Christianly way over the breakfast table to people whom you love. It's something to think about. It's the shape of the Christian life. Or how about James 5? You ever preached on this one? If anyone is sick, let him call the elders of the church to anoint him with oil. There is a practice. When I was in Princeton, there was a woman dying in Princeton University Hospital. She was a member of Nassau Presbyterian Church, and she called the pastor of the church and said, "I've been reading the book of James, and I would like for you to bring the elders over here to the hospital to anoint me with oil." The minister said, "Oh, Graylin, I don't think so." She said, "Why?" He said, "I practice ministry, not magic." She became furious. She said, "I want to tell you something. I am dying. I maybe have a week left. Well, why do you want me to come anoint you with oil if you're dying?" "Because I am baptized, and it will be a reminder to me that Jesus Christ is with me not only in my living, but also in my dying." The very next evening, the session of Nassau Presbyterian Church went to Princeton Hospital and anointed Graylin with oil. It's just a practice. It's just condensed sacramentality, but it's worth thinking about. What shape does the Christian faith take? If your belief has legs and arms, if it takes motion and action in the world. There's a verse in Hebrews 13, "Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for in doing so, many have entertained angels unawares." When I was a teenager, we worshiped in a little clapboard Presbyterian church in the country outside of Atlanta. The congregation were farmers and school teachers. And our preacher was preaching in the middle of a service one time when suddenly a stranger entered in the front door of the church. We looked back there. We didn't recognize him. Who was this guy? We were right by the Buford Highway. Maybe he was hitchhiking and saw the church. We were by the Southern Railroad. A lot of people rode on the boxcars in those days, and maybe he was one of those, a hobo going somewhere, and got off. Who was this guy? The preacher looked at him for a minute and then decided to keep on preaching, and as he did, the guy started up the side aisle of the church looking at us intently, and we were looking at him. Who was this guy? And then Well, we'll never know, because an expression of alarm crossed his face, and he ran back down the aisle of the church and out the door, and we never saw him again. But for weeks after that, every Sunday, the adults in the congregation would stand under the oak trees in front of the church and discuss what had happened, and they finally came to a red clay Georgia farmer theological consensus. And that was that we had not had our worship invaded by a vagrant, but that we had failed a moral test. That God had given us a stranger, and we had not shown the hospitality that Christ calls us to show. We had no idea that the church had already discussed this hundreds of years earlier in a fourth century liturgical document called Didaskalia. It raises the question in Didaskalia, what would you do, O church, if you were gathered at the table and a stranger entered your midst and there was not room for the stranger at the table or enough food? What would you do, O church? Answer, you, O bishop, sit on the floor, that there may be room for the stranger, for you yourselves were once strangers and God brought you to the table. It's in the practice of the church. And in my preaching, I have often stopped with the ideas and the promises and the claims, but not moved to the forms that this would take if we actually believed it. The last is the no longer astonished. I was struck the other day when I went through the New Testament how many times the ministry of Jesus precipitates astonishment. We heard it in the text that was part of our worship this morning. Jesus created astonishment by what he said and what he did. My favorite is the raising of Jairus' daughter in the Gospel of Mark. In the King James Version, it reads, "And they were astonished with a great astonishment." Now, if the ministry of Jesus created astonishment, are there not in our congregation people for whom this story has lost its capacity to amaze? For whom it is now routine? For whom it is no longer good news? Walker Percy, in one of his essays in The Message in the Bottle, imagines an academic conference at Estes Park, Colorado, and scholars in all fields are reading learned papers to each other, one after the other, as the convention assembly hears the best scholarship in the world. Percy imagines that in the middle of this conference, the building catches on fire, and a man rushes to the microphone and says, "Follow me, I know the way out." Immediately, said Percy, everybody there would recognize the difference in communication between the papers being read and what the man at the microphone said. One, said Percy, is information. The other is news. We're in the news division of the church. News, news. When the women came from the empty tomb, they announced not just information, but news. He's risen. The tomb is empty. And I think one measure of our sermons is, over time, are we able to say about our preaching that in our sermons there's the flavor of something has happened and everything is changed. Something has happened and everything is changed. Do we announce news in our preaching? Now, how can people lose their appetite for the news? How can people hear what we preach or what we read in the Gospels and not be astonished by the way God has acted in the world? Well, I'll give several reasons why I think that's true. First of all, my congregation and yours is too rich. It's hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. Somebody said that once. And when you're rich, you don't want any news disrupting the steady drumbeat of information that holds your world together. I shouldn't say your world, our world. It's me too. John Polkinghorne, the scientist theologian, has said, "It is really interesting how the Christian vocabulary has shifted from I hope to I hope not." When people are hungry and desperate, when they know they depend upon God, it arouses their hope. I hope God will save me mightily. But when you are content with your life, I hope I don't get Alzheimer's. I hope we don't have another recession. I hope my children don't get hooked on drugs. We begin to speak about our sense of the future in terms of I hope not. And when we begin to do that, we are no longer alert to the announcement of news. There is also a sense for veteran Christians like me of entitlement. That surely God is gracious and loving, and I'm entitled to that now. And so it no longer startles me or astonishes me or amazes me. My predecessor at Emory, Fred Craddock, used to love to start his classes every semester by telling the class a story. The story he would tell is this. Once upon a time, there was a seminary professor, and on the first day of class, he told the students that all of the grade in this class is dependent upon one final paper, and it is due on the last day of class. If you do not submit that paper by the last day of class, you flunk this course. On the last day of class, everybody had their paper, except for three students. The first one came forward and said, "Professor, I'm so sorry I wasn't able to finish it. I was on the bibliography when suddenly my in-laws arrived unexpectedly from out of town. I had to drop everything and show hospitality." "Well, I'm glad you're a person of hospitality," said the professor, "but you flunked the course." The second student came forward and said, "I was almost done. I was on the last paragraph when suddenly I came down with 103 degree temperature. I had the flu. I couldn't get it done." "Well, I'm sorry you were sick, but you flunked the course." The third student, having seen what happened to the first two, came forward trembling and said, "I was just about to finish my paper when my wife went into premature labor. We had to rush her to the hospital. Fortunately, she and the baby are fine. We've named him after you." "Well, I'm deeply honored, but you also flunked the course." The campus was outraged. "How can this man act this way?" So they formed a deputation to confront him. And when they did, he said, "On the first day of class, I gave my word that if the papers were not done by the last day of class, they would fail the course. And if you can't trust the word of the seminary professor, whose can you trust?" Now, Fred told that every semester, and he said the students didn't like that story. And one of the reasons they didn't like that story is that it didn't end right. It was supposed to end with grace. And in fact, they were entitled to it ending with grace. And Fred said, "If you ever believe you are entitled to grace, it is no longer grace." There is maybe a sense of entitlement. But you know, maybe most of all, I think the way that I have preached about the love of God has desensitized my congregation to being astonished and to the good news. I get out of my car, and I walk across the parking lot of a church where I'm going to be preached, and I really am happy to see those bumper stickers that say coexist and God loves all nations, because that's what I'm going to preach. I'm going to preach that God's love is not a narrow sectarianism, that it's a love for all people. It is an inclusive love, and I believe that. And do you know what? I preach that in every sermon, and they don't believe a word of it. And the reason they don't believe a word of it is that the way that I preach preach it, presents God, in effect, as a kind of benign blimp that floats over all humanity, beaming down benevolence upon all people. And actually, nobody wants that kind of love. When my son David was a little boy and he was frightened or had done something wrong, he would sometimes say to me, "Daddy, do you love me?" And what I would say to him, of course, is, "Well, of course I love you. I love all children." Nobody wants that. And as a matter of fact, in Scripture, that's not what we get. We don't have a God who promiscuously beams an anonymous love down on people. We have a God who fell in love with Abraham and who said, "I choose you." And in Jesus Christ, that love that chooses has chosen us all. And it's that chosenness, that adoption that takes place, that gives the love of Jesus Christ a kind of cutting edge to it. It's not a love that's anonymous, it's a love that knows and sees and chooses. And when I can announce it that way, it can strike people as true love, astonishing love. Now, it seems to me that the best way to get at this is not to do exegesis that goes to the biblical text, turning its back on the congregation, gets the meaning of the text and drops it on people on Sunday morning, but instead exegesis that takes the text and swings it as a lens between you and your people and your culture and looks through the lens to see what is God doing in the world right now. The lens becomes a way of seeing how God operates in the world. That's what Daniel Pott, who taught at Vanderbilt, said. He said when Paul was called to preach to the Gentiles, he had a problem on his hands because he had a Jewish apocalyptic gospel that he had to go give Hellenistic people. How is he going to do that? Well, one possibility, said Pott, is he could take that Jewish apocalyptic gospel and translate it into Hellenistic terms. That's playing poker with a house. You lose the zest of it. He could say to them, "I want you to believe the Jewish apocalyptic gospel." They wouldn't understand the vocabulary. So what he did was he looked through it and he saw cross resurrection everywhere he could see. And he said in places like Corinth, God is at work there, God is at work here, God is at work over there. And some believed him and some did not, but it was news. Because it was the news of a God who is active, choosing, vital, life-giving in their very midst. We got to preach news. Now, here's a text that is coming up in the lectionary in a few weeks. It's an alternate gospel. There's another reading for the same day, but I picked this one because it's short and it's fairly well known. It's John 5. After this, there was a festival of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now in Jerusalem by the sheep gate, there's a pool called in Hebrew Bethzatha, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there for a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am making my way, someone else steps down ahead of me." Jesus said to him, "Stand up, take your mat, walk." At once the man was made well, and he took up his mat and began to walk. Now that day was a Sabbath. Now what I would like to do is ask you, what do you find in this text that speaks to enchantment? What do you find in this text that speaks to formation? And what's the astonishment of this text? Pick any category and just toss some ideas out. Okay. He lives in a world where the holy is not just there when Jesus walks up, but is there as a possibility all the time. Good.
Any? At once the man was made well.
Okay. Whew. All right, good.
I see a formation disconnect that the practices the man is doing or wanting to do are not the things that are going to do it.
Okay.
He's asking for what should I do?
You see the malformation.
That's a
good way to ask that question. Sometimes we do have practices, but they're malformations. Do you see any formation in there? Anyone?
I see formation. Jesus said to him, stand up, take your mat, and walk. He's asking you to be a part of this miracle.
Yeah, it's not just stand up and be healed. It's stand up, take your mat, and walk. And that walking is probably more than just taking a couple of steps. It's a way of life that comes out of that healing. Yes? There's something that the man does that participates in the healing action of Jesus. We can over-psychologize, do you want to be healed? But there is a sense in which his response is instrumental in the healing, that certain practices participate in that.
It's not the water that makes it well.
Okay.
Wait,
and that never happens in our culture where people sit by the wrong thing. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think the astonishment across the passage is that it was common for the Sabbath to change their heart.
It happened when it wasn't supposed to, and it also happened. The has been sitting there for 38 years. I mean, you think it would be abandon all hope, ye who enter here. If you've been sitting there 38 years, and then suddenly, in an astonishing way, it happens. It's like it's like the Passover pilgrims. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord is like welcome to Hawaii. That's what Jews say when the tourists come into town. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Then all of a sudden, after years and years and years, it happens. It comes. Somebody had a, yes. So he never does say yes. Is that your point? Yeah. But okay. Good. Good. Yes.
Well, that Jesus even notices him. He's been there for 38 years, and no one has ever helped
him.
He's part of the
furniture. Yeah. Is that enchantment or astonishment or practice?
Astonishment, but I don't know. I mean, it's also a formation.
Yeah. It struck me when you were saying it that it's a kind of hypothetical lack of formation. He's got no community around him whatsoever to either kick him into the water or to say, the water's not going to help you. There's no community. Yes.
I'm wondering about enchantment and the question, would be what Jesus answer? I'm wondering if the quickness of Jesus just to say,
yeah, Jesus definitely brings a value added to this.
So I'm thinking that the Gospels always tell us stories about when Jesus, if we just think about Jesus as being a man, let's think about him. He's always able to do something. They're always, but when somebody comes to us, we're not always able to do something, but sometimes we are. And I'm thinking that maybe the astonishment is that sometimes we are, and we've gotten so used to thinking that we are not able that we don't even try.
Yeah, I think it's important here, just to riff on what you're saying. There are things in this text that we cannot do that are done by, we are on hand for that which is at hand, but not in hand. There is a healing here that only God in Christ gives. But there are practices of healing because of this that we engage in, that participate in, and are derived from this. There are things we can do. Yes. The water's irrelevant. Take up your mat and walk.
And I love that walking metaphor because it connects biblically with everything from the Exodus to moving through into the Promised Land. That salvation is the notion of the Hebrew word means room to walk around in. And suddenly the man's got up who had no future, 38 years of wasted stuff. He's got a future now. I think your insights are fantastic here, and I can see one sermon with a lot of spokes, or I can see 50 sermons on this particular text. In terms of enchantment, it strikes me that people will wonder, gosh, I wish I could be healed, who are in need of healing in a congregation. This guy got lucky because Jesus came his way but doesn't come ours. And it's good to preach it that miracles like this in the New Testament are not magic tricks or demonstrations just demonstrations of power. They're revelations of what is true, that you could say that Jesus didn't heal every sick person he ever was in his environment, but the healing of these is a disclosure of what is true about everyone. I hate the grocery shop, but I do it. My wife and I divide up that responsibility. And one day it was my turn, and I was at the grocery store, and I was in a foul mood. And what made it worse was that I ran into some people who were enjoying grocery shopping. It was a mother and her son, and they had figured out a way to make a game out of it. She had a list, and she would point to the next item on the list, aluminum foil, and he knew just the kind that they bought. He would run around the store till he found the aluminum foil, get the rentals, and come back to the buggy and hold it up like a trophy, and she would clap and paper towels, whoo, off he'd go to get the paper towels. Well, you know, when you meet people in a grocery store, you're going to meet them every aisle. And it was about the third aisle over that I realized that her son was mentally challenged. And I was staring at them, shouldn't have, but I was staring at them because it just, all of a sudden, I saw that. And she caught me looking at them and it embarrassed me. And I said, I was just admiring your relationship with your son. And she said, oh yes, he is a gift from God. Now that's enchantment. Where I saw a mental challenge, she saw a divine gift. She saw the presence of the healing Christ. That's enchantment. One Sunday at our church, we had, who's the guy who wrote Rich Christians in a Poor World? Ron Sider. We had Ron Sider preaching for us that day. And Ron Sider preached a really passionate social justice sermon. And our pastor was sitting up there with him, and I could tell just by body language that our pastor was getting caught up in the sermon. And we had the Eucharist after that, and our pastor came down and threw the prayer book out and improvised the call to the table. He said, if you are hungry for justice, come to this table. If you are thirsty for justice to fill the earth,
come to this table. And we sat there and listened to this, and it was, oh yeah, that's good. It's very clever. He's able to improvise. Sitting up in the balcony was Angela, a homeless woman who worshiped with us every week. And when she heard, if you are hungry for justice, come to this table, she was hungry and she was astonished. And she jumped up from her seat. She bounded like a gazelle down the steps of the balcony into the narthex, raced up the center aisle of the church, and like Ernie Banks sliding into second, she slid up to the table, and our pastor looked at her like, who are you? What is this? And then he said, we're going to feed the choir first. I thought, come on, man, you're announcing the astonishment of the gospel up there. I'm so grateful that Angela preached the sermon that day because she knows the gospel is astonishing. Any questions or issues that you want to raise in our last few minutes that may or may not have to do with what I talked about? I have an airline ticket, so you can ask me anything. Two responses to that. First of all, like most practical theologians, I have this sort of inherent tendency to go for pathologies. So you're reminding me, you know, we do have the well who are there, who need to be fed, along with those who are needing something extraordinary. So thank you for that. The other is, I should have said more clearly, I don't mean for these three. I'm not even sure these three are in your church, and they certainly don't exhaust the constituencies in your church. This is an invitation to make a longer list and a better list for yourself than I'm able to make. But thank you for pulling me back to the center on that. That's very helpful. Yes.
Right.
that they were actually not forming Christians, but just better consumers, and consumers of religion in their particular case. And so they set about to change the water in the aquarium and to take on the consumerist commodification of faith. I see a difference between that and a pastor who knows the people in the congregation trying to articulate the gospel in a way that these people can hear it and need to hear it. I'm not standing up there and saying, what are your needs today? I think I can probably meet them. but it's a good danger to raise that if we are, Mark used to raise it all the time. He says, you know, sometimes the scripture answers our questions, and sometimes it calls our questions into question. And it's that last little move that you keep in mind. Sometimes your needs are not the things that the gospel wishes to speak to you today. It's a good word to have.
Yes.
In an Episcopal context, as a Eucharist-centered community, it strikes me that all three, the enchantment, formation, and news, will all be present in the sacraments. And so whenever we can link our sermons to the sacramental life, especially Eucharist, that if we don't have the words, the action that is about to come is going to happen immediately. So we, for these things that you've listed, we seem to have kind of a built-in touchstone. Yeah.
Amen. And that was not me speaking, although I do agree with you. That was my wife, who's not here, who teaches liturgical theology, saying, absolutely, absolutely. She's got this really rhythmic, musical relationship between preaching and the sacraments. It's not that one does exactly the same role as the other, but they dovetail together in the word articulating what's present in the sacrament embodied what was promised and proclaimed in the word. And yes?
One thing that strikes me is that some of us work in contexts where we are in different congregations almost every Sunday. And so much of the work of the preacher is based on the knowledge of context. And yet, it's Sunday and we're called to preach. Finding a place to lift up that notion, the notions of these three areas that you are highlighting, becomes particularly difficult.
I agree with you. That's my life. You know, I travel around and fly with people at 40,000 feet and speak the word. And I'm envious as I can be of those who get next week, and the next week, and the next week, and those who hear it in the context. I think you're better preachers for it. And I would not say that what I do or you do is not preaching, but at least my methodology about this is I am always speaking to a kind of hypothetical listener. Now, I'm not stupid, so I'm able to know that these people do live in American culture in 2019, and there are certain human things that we all share, and so I can speak the gospel to those, but I can't speak to the fight that's going on about the music in the choir, or to the four people in the congregation who have recently discovered that they have cancer. You know, that's not accessible to me, and so it's got to come from the one who knows. It doesn't have to be the preacher always. The layperson who leads the prayers can be the person who contextualizes the promises that we made. But I don't think I would say twice. Last one.
Various communities might be
outside the house to speak with those who have never heard the enchantment or astonishment or formationism or the goodness of the good news, when it runs a risk of alienating some of those who have. And I don't know of any way to protect the preacher from being crucified. It's just not in our history that happens. You know, some people get to die of the flu, we get to die of prophecy. That's the way it goes. But I think pastorally, this does provide a possibility of understanding to say, I want to speak now to those for a moment who probably have never heard the goodness that the rest of us have heard because they've heard words of exclusion and shunning. I want to speak to this LGBTQI community. And that affords the possibility that a congregant who wouldn't want a sermon addressed to that can patiently sit and hear that word being given. The more vexing part of your question is, increasingly the people who we want to hear the established part of the gospel aren't present to hear it. And I am encouraged by the recent graduates from seminary who, I mean, this is the way God works. In our tradition, they are not able to find churches. We do not have enough viable churches for our graduates to fill. And so they are creating alternative worshiping communities in taverns and in the lobbies of apartment buildings and all kinds of places. And people who would never come inside a church to hear it are able to be in the place where they can hear it. In our church in Atlanta, we have had over the last 15, 20 years a whole lot of homeless people who've become a part of the congregation. Really messed up our preaching because we can no longer say it is our responsibility to care for the homeless. We are the homeless. They're our brothers and sisters in Christ. But there is a group of homeless people who do not trust institutions and will not come inside of the building. It's called service resistant in some social work quarters. So our assistant pastors have been taking their guitars out on the sidewalk and having worship on the sidewalk. And there's been a good response to that. And last year, one of the assistants had just finished a service out on the sidewalk, and she said, look, I know you guys don't like to come in the church. I know you don't want to come in the church. But there's a service on Wednesday that I think you might find really cool. It's called Ash Wednesday. And she said, what's going to happen is, you saw us marching around the block with those palm branches last year. We burned them in the ashes, and we mix them with oil, and our minister will put a cross on somebody's forehead, and then give them the oil and ashes, and they'll put a cross on somebody's forehead, and we'll pass it around, and you might like to come. I don't know how she did it, but 60 homeless people showed up pushing their carts and with their bundles and pushed into our little chapel where we have a coincidentally, we're across the street from the Georgia State Capitol. One of the legislators in session said that morning, I understand there's going to be an Ash Wednesday service at the church across the street. I'm going to go if anyone would like to join me. 40 state legislators. It was the kingdom of God. The homeless people putting crosses on the foreheads of the legislators, and the legislators putting crosses on the homeless people, the foreheads of the homeless. So, enchantment can move quickly, but some. Thank you so much for listening.
We have an announcement.